It's the roar of the presses, working day and night in the north, south, east, and west of our nation. These daily presses turn out 48 million newspapers, and behind these millions of headlines are the country's ace reporters who bring you the inside story. Tonight from Washington, D.C., NBC Television brings you America's press conference of the air, Meet the Press, where you'll meet top newsmen in an unrehearsed, spontaneous press conference with one of the outstanding personalities in today's news, Mr. Clark Clifford, special counsel to the president, who resigned from that position last Tuesday to return to his private law practice. Ready for the conference are four of America's top newsmen are here to ask the questions you would ask if you were here. And now meet Mr. Marquis Childs of United Features, whose column on national and international affairs appears in the leading newspapers of the country. Mr. Lawrence Spivak, editor of the American Mercury magazine, a regular member of our press panel. Mrs. May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald, who for many years has been a familiar figure at White House press conferences. Mr. Raymond P. Brandt, Washington correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, another distinguished newspaper man on tonight's panel. And here is our guest, Mr. Clark Clifford. Finally, Miss Martha Roundtree, moderator of Meet the Press.
Our guest this evening, Mr. Clark Clifford, was appointed special counsel to President Truman in June 1946. In that capacity, he was intimately associated with the president in the development of both foreign and domestic policies. Since he played such an important part in our government for so many years, what he has to say will be of particular interest, I'm sure, to all of us. I see Mr. Spivak has the first question.
Mr. Clifford, do you think the president invited Governor Duff of Pennsylvania to join the Democratic Party so that the Democrats would be sure of a candidate in 1952?
I wasn't familiar with the fact that that invitation had been extended, Mr. Spivak.
It was extended through the newspapers the other day. He said that Governor Duff was so liberal that he thought he belonged in the Democratic Party.
Well, I don't know whether that was an invitation or not. I remember that he made some such comment as that during the campaign about Governor Warren, and I didn't know that it constituted an invitation.
Well, Mr. Clifford, I'll be less subtle than I was. I know you're not a betting man, but maybe you're a guessing man. Do you think the president will run in 1952?
I've gone through some differences in my concept of that. I thought that perhaps after 1948, that maybe he had decided not to. Since that time, I must say my mind has been undergoing a change. I don't know if I would be willing to bet on it, but my inclination is that he may.
You'll never be hung for that one.
Mr. Childs.
Well, in that connection, Mr. Clifford, I suppose you'd go back to the White House to help him because he'd need you to write all those campaign speeches, wouldn't he?
Well, I don't suppose that you'd say I wrote them all. I worked with him on them. If any time he wanted me to come back to work with him again, I'd be only too happy to.
You know, that's an awfully interesting thing. You announced you were going to leave your government position. You were getting, I think, $20,000 a year. Because you had to make some money to live on. It seems to me the people out in the country are going to think that's kind of odd, aren't they? $20,000 sounds like quite a lot of money out there.
No, you have to take into consideration that between my service in the Navy and my service in government, I've been away from the practice for 6.5 years. During all of that period, except the last 3 months, my compensation was very much less than the 20. And during that time, I incurred obligations that I feel I must now retire, perhaps in the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, the disturbing thing to me, in a way, Mr. Clifford, is that it implies there can't be continuity in government service. Now, the president sent you a letter that was, I mean, really a beauty, Mr. Clifford, and surely you're the kind of man we need in government. Now, isn't that rather disturbing to you? Would you say that you'd have to have a salary of, well, I mean, how can you say? Can you tell us?
No, yes, I could say that very well.
How much, $50,000?
No, I could say that if I were given the opportunity to get back into private life and recoup my economic situation, which has become so serious the last 6 years, then after a period of time, however long it might take me, then I might be in position to come back into government again. I think that we're going to find as time goes on that men who have had experience in government can come in and stay for 4 years or so, which I did. And then perhaps they had better get out and look after some of their personal problems. After taking care of those, come back into government in some other capacity where they can utilize the training that they've had.
Mrs. Craig.
Mr. Clifford, I'd like to go back to what the President said about the Republicans all coming in the Democratic Party, and I'd like to ask you, do you feel that way? Do you think everybody ought to be Democratic and have only one party in this country?
Oh, no. No, I don't at all. I'm a deep believer in the two-party system. I think it's been one of the great elements that's made this country great. And I think that when you get away from the two-party system, as they have in some other countries, and splinter parties grow up, then I think you have a dangerous political situation.
It has been said, in a recent Collier's article about Dr. Ewing and the New Dealers, that they aim to write and put through legislation to keep the Democrats in power.
Well, I suppose that any party in power likes to stay in power. And I don't know of any way that a party can prepare and write and put through legislation that perhaps can keep them in power in perpetuity.
Isn't that what you've been doing for the last few years?
Well, what we've been doing, we believe, has been the right course for the country to take. And if those policies prove to have been right for the country, then I think the people will keep the Democratic Party in power.
Well, now, have not those policies tended to centralize power in the government, to make the people more and more dependent on the government, and then in that way, unable to get loose from the domination of one party?
Oh, no. I don't think so at all. I think exactly the opposite has taken place. I think that when people are given security through the result of their own efforts in their jobs, as an illustration, and they have social security, and they have minimum wages, and they have education, and those different so-called welfare state policies, I think it makes them more independent. I think as people are better educated, their health is better, their personal security is better, I think it makes them independent and not dependent upon the government.
You don't think it makes them irresponsible?
I don't think so at all.
When everything's done for you, you don't have to do anything for yourself?
Oh, no, that isn't it now. Oh, no, that isn't, I don't think that's fair. The government is not doing everything for the people. The government says, if you work, we will assist you in your problem of security for yourself and your family. But you have to do the main job. The government isn't going to do the job for you. The government will help you do it if you evidence the desire to help yourself.
Mr. Brandt.
Well, you were talking about security. I'd like to get back to the question that Mark asked, the $20,000 a year salary. First, it indicates that you are intend to go back into government some later time after you have managed your own security. Am I right in that?
Well, I think it would be a fine opportunity again for service, perhaps. For in the last 4 years, I've had fine training. At some time in the future, I would like to utilize that training again in government service. But after devoting 6 years to meeting what I hope is my responsibility to my government, I felt that the time had come to meet my responsibility to my family.
Well, on that point, your salary before you got the 20 was 12.
Yes, it was 12.
And could you, at $20,000, maintain yourself in Washington during that 4 or 5 years?
I think that is possible.
Well, now, that comes to this question. For men at your level of in policy making and at the White House, what do you think is an adequate salary to have them stay in government, not to go out after 4 or 5 years?
Well, I don't know that I could set any figure. I think the figure that the President raised my salary to, or the salary of counsel, I think that's an adequate salary in government. I think that good men can be obtained for that. And had I started at that and not encountered all of the obligations which I have now incurred, I could have remained there.
Mr. Clifford.
Mr. Spivak.
If taxes remain as high as they are, how do you expect to save enough money so that you can never come back to government again?
Well, I don't know whether it's the question of saving. And what I want to do now is retire the obligations that I have incurred in the last 6 years when I've been away from my practice. And first in the Navy for 2.5 years, and then in the White House, I want now to retire those obligations.
You think you're going to be able to do that with taxes as high as they are?
Yes, I think that I can. I think that I can.
Do you think you might ever utilize your experience by running for public office?
That does now not occur to me.
Mr. Clifford, I'd like to be fair about this. Is it not true? I don't like your expression.
Yeah.
Is it not true that the mortality in the policy level is very high and that you can't depend on any continuity in your job? The Democrats might be defeated or you might get out of favor or something like that.
Yeah, I don't quite know what your point is. I'm not talking about coming back maybe in a year or 2 years. I hope I have 30 years more of serviceable, useful life. During that period, I may be called back into government.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't make it clear. I meant that if you're not sure of some continuity of employment, you've got to have a higher salary. If you're only going to be
a couple of years. I don't know how the government can meet that particular problem. I don't know that the government can pay the types of salaries that permit a person to live on a good level and still save enough. I doubt that you can do that.
Hmm.
I think that when you go into government service, you have to accept as part of that service the natural sacrifice that you make.
Mr. Child.
Mr. Clifford, you may have heard that there are lawyers here about town called lobby lawyers who rarely go into courts and usually practice what is called an influence business. Now, it's been reported that you're going to take as a client one of the large aviation companies that's seeking a very important decision out of the government. Are you going to take that aviation company as a client?
No, I'm not. I heard that report also. And the fact is that the report is untrue and completely unfounded. And I don't intend to represent that particular company or any other company that would expect me to do lobbying in Washington.
In other words, you expect to go into courts occasionally,
do you? I expect to practice law here.
That'll be very rare, Mr. Clifford.
Well, I intend to do it. I did it for 16 years before I went into government, and I intend to go back to it because I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Then you're not going to be a 5%er.
No, I don't intend to be a 5%er or any kind of percenter.
Well, how can you prevent people from trying to use your influence? In the last few years, of course, you have acquired influence and important friends. Clients will try to utilize that, won't they?
Yes, but that decision rests with me as to whether I shall try to prevail upon any element of relationship that I may have with persons. That is my responsibility. I do not intend to use it, nor should I try to use it with the men who are in government today. I believe that it would be of no avail. That's the respect that I have for them.
Well, that is not what came out of the 5% hearing, though, Mr. Clifford. I mean, and plenty of influence peddled around. You know that. Came out at the hearing on the 5%.
Well, I don't know what that has to do with me. For you asked, someone asked the question, did I intend to get into the 5% type of business? I have no inclination, or will I under any circumstances get into that kind of business.
Mr. Brandt.
Well, just as a matter of fact, after you've been in government in a position such as yours, for 5 years, doors are open to you that are perhaps not open to other lawyers. And that may account for these reports of these very high income you're going to make.
Well, the reports about my income, it seems to me, are premature. Someone wrote a story at the very beginning and stated some figure. And curiously enough, others just came along and picked it up. There's no basis whatsoever. I'm steering out into uncharted waters. I hope I do well, but I don't know yet how it's going to go.
You don't know how much you can count on at this moment.
I have no idea.
In other words, you don't know whether you'll make $10 a week or not.
Well, I would expect to do better than that.
How'd you do the last 2 days?
Well, I've spent the last 2 days with plasterers and carpenters and all, and the clients can't find their way in.
All out, go, no income.
You admit there are some clients trying to get in, though.
Well, some of the best law firms in Washington are registered as lobbyists for various clients. Will you, do you think at any time you will be registered as a lobbyist?
It doesn't occur to me that I would. I am unable to foresee all situations, but I know of no situation today that would require me to register as a lobbyist.
Mr. Childs.
I'd like to get you back on your government service, your long and sometimes, I'm sure, arduous service. It's often been reported that in all the debates in the White House on policymaking, you carried the side of the left, of the liberal. It's often been reported that in all the debates in the White House on policymaking, you carried the side of the left, of the liberal. And yours was the influence for the so-called welfare state. Is that roughly true, Mr. Clifton?
Well, I think that in every controversy that came up, I urged a liberal, progressive course. I felt that deeply and urged it as strongly as I could.
You were for the, for example, for the medical plan.
You bet, insurance. Yes.
You must then have had a great deal to do with the whistle-stop campaign of 48.
Yes, I worked hard on that.
Mr. Clifford, did you have anything to do with the formulation of the Truman Doctrine in 47?
Well, it became my task in the early part of 47 to work with State Department. I recall attending a whole day session at the Pentagon with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which perhaps was the genesis of some of the thinking that went into that, when the British were told us they were going to withdraw from Greece and Turkey. Then in the early part of 47, it was my function to work with the president in the preparation of the message in which the Truman Doctrine was enunciated.
Maybe you can explain this to me. I quote from the Truman Doctrine. It must be the policy of this nation to support the free peoples of the world who are fighting to retain their freedom, which was a very noble statement in the Truman Doctrine. Now, what happened to that principle, do you think, in China?
Well, then the sentence goes on. To help them retain their freedom, and to, the language there, to prevent subjugation by armed minorities or from pressure from without, I think is the conclusion of that sentence that you refer to in the Truman Doctrine.
Even so.
That would.
All right. Very briefly, I would say that that general statement of policy presupposes that this country will do the best that it can with what it has to work with. There are problems all over the world. We're facing those problems as best we can, I believe. And I don't believe that we can meet every problem in every part of the world at every time. Now, I believe that it is the purpose of this country and this administration to help the Chinese people. And I believe that that assistance will be extended as best it can be. I do not know that this is the particular time to follow that particular policy there at that particular spot. We have to do the best we can with what we have to work with.
You think we've just, if we tried to go into China, that we'd just bite off more than we can chew?
Well, we've already extended billions of dollars of aid to China. It has reached the stage where the president feels that should we extend great sums now in aid of China, that we probably would not get the benefit from it that we should be getting.
Did China get the benefit from any of that money, Mr. Clifford?
It is my belief that China got considerable benefit from the money.
Because I'm told that they didn't.
It is our belief that they received a great deal of benefit from it.
Mrs. Cray.
Mr. Clifford, I'd like to change the subject. There's a great shock around Washington about the revelations about Mr. Fuchs giving away the atomic secret. Do you think that, as some people think, our government in high places is shot through with communism, that there are others betraying us from within?
Well, it is my belief that in high places in government, there is no betrayal of any kind taking place in as far as this country's policies are concerned. I don't understand that there was any betrayal in high places in this country as a result of Mr. Fuchs' actions. About which I do not know personally. Apparently, he was a visitor to this country and had certain credentials which may have entitled him to certain information. But I know of no charge, even, that anyone in giving him information betrayed this country.
Would you mind saying what you think of the Alger Hiss conviction?
I have no personal information about it. My only knowledge of the matter is what I have read in the papers. As far as my personal opinion of Alger Hiss is concerned, I think it inadvisable to make a comment while that case is still pending in court. It is not adjudicated.
Then do you think, sir, that the Secretary of State should have done so under the same circumstances?
My reaction to that would be this. I have the greatest confidence and respect for Dean Acheson. I've worked with him for 4 years as undersecretary and a secretary of state. I have the greatest confidence in his judgment and in his loyalty. And if he chose, for some reasons of his own, to make the comment that he did, personally and as an individual, it's good enough for me.
In that connection, I would like to ask whether you believe he will remain as Secretary of State in spite of the criticism from Capitol Hill.
I am sure that he will.
You think the President
has exactly the feeling toward Dean Acheson that I have.
He retains the same confidence he has always.
He has the utmost confidence in him.
Mr. Bryant.
Your predecessor, Judge Roseman, became the historian for Franklin Roosevelt. Have you any plans for writing the public papers of Harry S. Truman?
No, I made a decision early in the work that I was doing that I could do one of two things. I could either do the work or I could keep a diary. And I decided to do the work.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Clifford, there's been a great deal of talk about the New Deal and the Fair Deal. Could you tell us whether there is any material difference between the two deals?
Well, I'd say very briefly this, that the New Deal presented a great many principles and programs. The Fair Deal was the result of an analysis of the programs of the New Deal, resulting in some of them being adopted, some of them being rejected, and maybe some new ones being added. I think it was a modernization and a bringing up to date of policies that had come up over the years.
Well, one of the new ones that seems to have been added is the civil rights program as a pretty definite part of your platform. Now, a congressman the other day said that everybody wants civil rights as an issue, but not as a law. Now, what do you think of that statement?
I disagree with it. I think it's not true. I think every action the president has taken on the civil rights issue indicate that he firmly and sincerely believes that his civil rights program should go through. He has offered specific laws to the Congress and has asked them to pass it on anti-poll tax, anti-lynching, FEPC, right down the line.
Well, Mr. Clifford, the President, by simple directive, could have done away, for example, with segregation in the armed forces, and yet, for some reason best known to himself, never did. There are many things in this city itself which the Democratic Party controls, which might have been changed in Washington, and yet hasn't been changed. Now, why do you think that's so?
Well, no, I'll need a minute on that, if you'll give me just a minute.
You can split them up. Split them up. Take the Army.
Quest.
All right, take the Army.
No, take the Army. The President, through his secretaries of the armed forces, has made real progress in eradicating segregation from the armed services. And I say that. Real progress has been made because that was one of the elements that I worked on for some 4 years. Now, the President could, by executive order, completely eliminate any remaining vestiges of discrimination. At the same time, that's tied in with a very important problem. And that is, we're raising most of our manpower and personnel in the armed services by voluntary enlistment today. And should he go completely the whole way on these discriminatory problems, you could then very seriously affect the number of those who are enlisting for the armed services. So I think that he has to take into consideration the relative importance of these matters, bring one along as he's bringing the other along, and find reasonable balances between what might be conflicting issues. With reference to the district, I hurry and try and get this in. With reference to the district, the President can do very little himself by order. He has to put up programs to the Congress, and the Congress passes the laws that affect the district. And as you know, we have had some difficulty in getting through programs. He has asked time and time again for certain laws respecting the district, which the Congress has not yet gotten around to passing.
Doesn't he control that district committee, though, for the most part?
Oh, my, no. Oh, no, he doesn't at all. He submits recommendations to the Congress. When they apply to the district, they go to the district committee. They reach their independent judgment as to what their recommendations to the Congress will be. They have not seen fit for the last 2 or 3 years, for instance, to give what is really a major element of citizenship, the right to vote for people in the district.
And shortings, for the theory, but he finds that in practice it's rather difficult to carry out.
For the president?
Yes.
Oh, sure. He recommends...
Isn't that essentially the problem as the South itself sees it, maintains that they may be for the theory, but the practice of doing away with segregation today is a very difficult one?
Well, I think the only answer I could give to that is that it cannot be done today, and it can't be done next month. But we feel that we are making gradual progress, that each month maybe we're making a little progress, and over a period of months and years that finally the solution to the problem will be found.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, in that respect, Mr. Clifford, responsible Southerners have indicated they would take a reasonable compromise, and the President has apparently turned his face against it. A reasonable compromise would mean progress. Why does he refuse a compromise?
It isn't the President who accepts or rejects a compromise at this stage.
Well, he's told Dick Russell of Georgia that
he... All right. He has told Dick Russell and any number of other congressmen and senators what his attitude is. I think he is not going to recede from that as a matter of principle. Should they pass a bill which does not reach the full 100% of what he wants, he may believe that it is in the best interest of the country to sign that bill. But he would have to do that.
Mr. Bryan.
In the case of the Army, he's doing his own timing and doing it very gradually.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to us, at least to me, that he's presenting a whole package to the Congress and says, pass this. I mean, he doesn't make, allow them the time that he himself is using.
Well, I can't agree with that. I think he tells the Congress what the end result is that we should have, so that there won't be second-class citizens in this country. And it is up to the Congress. He cannot make that decision as to how fast they are going to go. The fact is the Congress, by reason of a number of elements of combination and so forth, have been making very little progress. He has merely said, this is the end result. And I ask you men to go to work on this program and produce results.
But on that point, he brings up the most difficult one, FEPC, as the first step.
Well, I don't know whether you want to look at it from the standpoint of whether it's the most difficult one or whether it would be the most beneficial to the Negro race. Let's look at it from that standpoint, that it would have the greatest benefit to the greatest number of that particular minority as any other plan that he's presented.
Yes, but he might get poll tax, he might get anti-lynching, and you do it by steps. He puts a hurdle there.
All right. On the other hand, he might, as a result of their taking that first, he might find that compromises would develop so that he would get other programs out of it.
Mrs. Craig.
If I may change the subject now, Mr. Clifford, it is also said that the administration would like to keep the Taft-Hartley law as an issue and really don't care about having it repealed. Now, what would we do by John L. Lewis if we had repealed the Taft-Hartley law?
Well, now, I doubt that one answer will answer that question because you start off and state a premise with which I disagree. You say that it is said
yes.
that the administration wants to keep on.
Sorry, it's not fair for me to interrupt here because I should give you more time, and I can't even give you time for one answer, Mr. Clifford, because our time is up. We assume you had the right answer for that one. In just a moment, we'll learn who I guess will be for next week.
Next Saturday evening, NBC Television will again present America's Press Conference of the Air, Meet the Press, over these same stations. Make a note now to join us then when our guest will be Mrs. J. Waitese Waring of Charleston, South Carolina, wife of Federal Judge Waring, who stirred up a hornet's nest in the South by her vigorous attack on white supremacy. And now, good night for Mr. Marquis Childs, Mr. Lawrence Spivak, Mrs. May Craig, Mr. Raymond P. Brandt, Miss Martha Roundtree, Mr. Clark Clifford. Meet the Press has come to you from Washington, D.C.
NBC Television.